Hello, everyone, and welcome to Quinn Cummings Gives Bad Advice, the podcast where I, Quinn Cummings, give advice to people I do not know. If you're joining us for the first time, you may be asking yourself, does Quinn really want to give me bad advice? And the answer is no, I do not want to give you bad advice. I want to give you good advice. But I have absolutely no qualification to give you any sort of advice at all. I am not a gastroenterologist. I am not a gun manufacturer. I am not a ghost. I give advice because it amuses me to do so. So you might be asking yourself, will this advice I'm about to give you be good advice? Well, I think the answer is in the title of the podcast. If you want me to give you bad advice, you can leave a question for me at qcbad.com. It's completely anonymous, and better yet, it's completely free, so I can offer up this advice with a 100% money-back guarantee. Now, let's get started. My first question today comes from the Chateau region of Twitter.
Dear Quinn, I'm a worker drone at a large corporation. I have recently opened an Etsy store to sell jewelry I make from seashells. It gives me a creative outlet, and it makes my seashell collecting hobby no longer a potential hoarding issue. How do I get more people to know about my business? I did send out an email to a lot of people at work, all of whom I know, but I was reprimanded for using corporate email for personal business. I don't think I have the self-promotion gene.
Consort works with startups. He helps them craft their business model. He always makes them answer the following two questions. To whom are you speaking? What do you want them to do? What do you want from this business? You say you like making things and it's a way of not getting buried in seashells. That's fair, but if that were it, you wouldn't care if you ever made a dime because the making should be enough and you can give away what you make. You want the recognition, which is more than fair. It's just hard for a lot of artists to admit that. They want to just be in it for the art. Approval is good. It's understandable. You want recognition. Fine. This just became a side hustle. Only the hustle is not making the jewelry. It's getting your work out there. It's going to mean learning tricks on Etsy, learning search engine optimization, possibly buying Facebook ads, which will mean learning about Facebook ads. Making the jewelry will become the reward for having done enough PR work that you're selling jewelry. I don't have a self-promotion gene. Maybe factual, but it is irrelevant. Everyone is shouting. Either shout or step off the trading floor. This comes from qcbad.com.
Hi, Quinn. I'm a 53-year-old woman with no significant other, children, or pets. I might have the opportunity to pet sit a kitty cat in Utrecht, Netherlands for a month over the Christmas and New Year holiday. I'd be by myself. I'd be in a country I really like, but in a city I've never visited, living in a stranger's apartment, by myself, on Christmas. Should I do it? Of course I should, right? You're never alone when there's a European Christmas market nearby, right? Would you do it?
I think what you're asking is, will I regret being on my own? Maybe, for a few minutes here and there. You're an adult. A little ache when you FaceTime with family and you notice the green beans with almonds are there on the table is acceptable. Family and traditions are also complicated and fraught. There isn't a single thing we do in the holiday season which isn't designed to touch an emotional chord. It is weeks of emotional overstimulation. People stagger back to work in January with the look of triathletes crossing the finish line. Fun fact? Nearly every major religion has a holiday of lights somewhere around the winter solstice. Human beings have no exoskeleton, no sharp nails. Our teeth are not designed for defense. We need to be reminded at our most vulnerable, in the darkness, that light will come back. Americans have turned this desire into a forced march from Thanksgiving to January 1st. I have been to Amsterdam in the late winter, and it was lovely. I have a friend who taught in Utrecht and raved about the city. You will light candles and sleep deeply and walk great distances and finish books and eat delicious things you don't need to share or explain. You will come back in January refreshed and missing your new friend, the Dutch cat. I think you might be surprised how many people envy you the decision you made. I say go. This came from QCBad.com.
So, after 15 years as an on-and-off couple, my partner and I broke up. She's 11 years younger than me, and I think the death of her father made her look at her life, and she started to make changes. She lost weight, started running, decided she wasn't in love with me. Problem is, we still live together, and she's my best friend. The biggest problem is that because I'm her best friend, she wants to tell me about her crush on the guy 11 years her senior, who is the physical version of her dad, and the emotional makeup of me. She doesn't see any of this and won't talk about therapy. Not for us, not for her. My question, should I move out?
Yes. Because she might be your best friend, but right now she is also a mess. And people who are a mess tend to drag everyone who cares about them into their mess with them. She will, completely unconsciously, of course, weaponize your love for her, your wish that she feel better, and she will aim it at your junk. She might be better later. She might not. You two might figure out a way to be lovers again or to be platonic friends again, or you might not. Grieving makes people weird, and it doesn't always progress in a neat line. And it certainly changes the person to whom it is happening. If you're renting together, it's easy. If you bought together, I'm sorry. But either way, your job is to protect yourself emotionally and financially. You can love her, but you need to do it from a distance. This one is from QCBad.com. Subject, no idea what I did.
Dear Quinn, my husband isn't a talk about his feelings person. I tend to flare up like a bonfire when something gets to me. Then I'm pretty much over it once I've wailed and gnashed teeth at whomever is nearby, even if it's just my dogs. He is naturally a frequent recipient of said wailing and gnashing, regardless of his role or lack thereof in what set me off. He got home from work today, Monday, and after I asked him about his day, he said he didn't feel like talking because of Sunday, yesterday. We were together all day. I recall nothing happening between us. Lunch, grocery shopping, and evening with friends. No arguments or even disagreements that I recall. I'm giving him his space, but I have no idea what I might have done or said to trigger him wanting space. And now I'm spiraling into, what the hell did I do, when I don't even know what he's pissed about? Any advice?
First of all, just to get this one out of the way, he doesn't feel like talking because of Sunday. If that's all he said, you're assuming it has something to do with you. There may be some mood that you are unaware of that is still dragging him down. Just because you're hearing about it doesn't mean it's about you. Maybe you don't know, and he's a huge sports enthusiast, and his team lost a game or a quarter. Again, I don't really know sports. But put that one away for a second. I am a seether in that I seethe. I get quiet and I just seethe when I'm angry. I am also a grown-ass person who realizes not everyone can see inside my head, and I tell Consort when he has hurt my feelings or made me frustrated. I mean, I usually tell him weeks later because I am a big weirdo, but I do eventually tell him. It's one thing to not talk about your feelings, but from what I'm reading, he has escalated this from, "Oh, I wish I had known you didn't want to see Fast and the Furious 15, to, "I have literally no idea what you might be talking about." Seething can easily become pouting, and pouting is a form of manipulation. He deserves to be heard, but you also deserve to be told. Go for a walk with the dogs. Encourage him to come along. If he comes along, don't make eye contact because that tends to escalate things, and just tell him the truth. You love him, you never knowingly hurt his feelings, and you need to know what happened. If he pushes back, tell him that you want to make sure it doesn't happen again, but you can't do that unless you know what happened. Then, as agonizing as it is, stop talking. The ball is in his court. Oh, I like this one.
Dear Quinn, my boss's breath could stop a runaway train going off a cliff. I am trapped several times a week across the desk from him in a small office, wondering if he can tell my eyes are watering and I'm breathing through my teeth. It isn't after meals or coffee. It is perpetual halitosis. Help. I love my job. I even really like him. But I'm suffocating.
I'm guessing there is no HR department you can deputize into this incredibly awkward conversation, otherwise you would have done that already. I think what you have to do is flip this. Try to imagine how you would like this to be handled were the breath on the other foot. Here is what I would want. It would be an email. It would say, "Dear Quinn, I think you know how much I love this job, how much I admire you and learn from you every day. You have always told me the truth, even when it was awkward, and you deserve the same in return. For the past few months, your breath has gotten strong, and I'm worried that there might be an underlying health issue. A friend was recently diagnosed with a condition that could have been corrected far earlier if he had realized strong breath was a symptom. Selfishly, I want you healthy so I can keep learning from you and working with you. You and I never need to talk about this. I just felt you deserved to know." Now, back to me. When you send this email, you aren't lying. Someone's friend somewhere did just get diagnosed with something. And strong breath is a more neutral descriptor than terrible breath. Once you send this email, you move on. You did what you could. This is from qcbad.com. Subject, Eeyore friend.
Dear Quinn, I have a friend who, when I get together with him, treats me to a list of the things and people who have slighted him in any way. He sees good things happening to other people, someone gets a good job, people going on vacation, etc., as a personal affront to him. He has been in therapy, and I hoped this would work itself out through that process, but he's still downtrodden by other people's good fortune. It's making me want to avoid his company. How do I kindly address this with him?
I am firmly of the belief that no one does something for no reason. It may not be a good reason. It may not be a reason that holds any relevance to who they are now. But no behavior exists in a vacuum. One of two things is going on here, I suspect. Either your friend really believes this, what he is telling you, or this is some vestigial organ left over from a pre-therapy time. A Pavlovian response to seeing your face that tells him, "Now is the time to air my grievances." There is only one way to find out. When the airing of grievances begins, you must gently cut it off and notice it without aggression. Just report what you hear. For example, Bill, are you aware you're talking about why unworthy people have money again? If he says yes, or starts into a deeper monologue about how truly unworthy they are of anything and how they have his money, cut it off again and ask with genuine curiosity, what do you get out of that? Because you are, in fact, interested. Let him talk a bit, then tell him the truth, which is that you understand his frustration with the world, but you're not eager to have this conversation anymore. Because here's the thing. You trained him to be this way. Unless I misunderstand, he's always been sort of an Eeyore. You've known him long enough to be disappointed therapy hasn't changed him more, which means he was like this before therapy and you didn't say anything then. You're asking him to change a very large behavior he might unconsciously associate with your presence. So treat this as you would if you were a reporter doing a cover story on him for Vanity Fair. Ask him open-ended questions about this outlook. Let him talk. When he sounds as if he's just going back to the packaged outrage, try to bring it to his attention. When he flags, as he eventually will, agree with him, because he's right. Life is unfair. That's not interesting. What we do with this information is interesting. Say to him, you know, I might have been up to this during the Obama administration, but it's too dark and weird right now to keep complaining. Just so you know, if you start talking about the things which you think are unfair, I am going to completely and ridiculously change the subject. And then do it. You heard him out. You explained that you wanted to change the rules of your friendship. And you told him how things would work going forward. Will this make the next couple of get-togethers weird? Yes. You're changing infrastructure, and anyone who lived through the big dig in Boston will tell you what a nightmare that was. But I suspect one of two things will happen. Either you two will find a new friendship, or he will move on to someone who is willing to listen to him complain about this friend he had who wouldn't let him complain.
Dear Quinn, what do you do when someone who follows you religiously and loves your every tweet asks that you make your jokes more accessible to users with low bandwidth? For example, to not use pictures from other software in your Twitter feed.
Well, why are you on Twitter? If it's to entertain yourself, you are under no obligation to amend your free content. If it's to build an audience and goodwill, and this person has enough followers to make it worth your while, you can decide to create a few things with that request in mind. But only you know the answer. This came from QCBad.com. Subject, when bad things happen, crickets.
Hi, Quinn. Approximately 18 months ago, my long, rapid stride as I walked became noticeably slower and shorter, and my balance worsened. I was diagnosed in 2005 with a nonspecific neurological diagnosis, which may or may not be the cause of my changing gait. Here's my dilemma. I'm a very private person. I wrote siblings and cousins a letter last year to keep them informed, as well as reduce my tendency to be stoic. I've tried to be selective in telling my friends. I've felt lonely and scared as I've navigated my medical care. I was so relieved to finally talk about it in person with someone I thought was trustworthy that I overshared. As a result, I've since made an effort to become less detailed when I tell others. I'm also making an effort to improve my self-compassion. I completely understand intellectually what happened. There was no way, however, to prepare myself emotionally for the grief and increased loneliness I feel. I've started thinking about finding new settings and situations in which I can meet people. Maybe check out a faith community in which I can feel a sense of belonging and reciprocity with others. Do you have any comments or suggestions for me?
A person you thought would be there for you failed to be there for you. This does not mean you were stupid or weak or overshared. This means you ran a stress test and the object you were testing was not up to it. After my father died when I was 9, my mother spoke of how few people who had been friends with them as a couple stayed around. People are flawed and they are weak. Now, what do you do with this information? First of all, I completely empathize. You did exactly what I would have done, which is tell very few people, be disappointed by one of the few people I did tell, and then want to retreat because, hey, who needs that? I'm so impressed that you're thinking about new communities, and I want you to give yourself credit for thinking that way. That's boldness, and I want you to be one step bolder. While looking at faith communities, I want you to consider a stand-up comedy class. Yeah, I know. Hear me out. Comedy, if it's worth a bucket of warm spit, springs from truth. And truth springs from the awkward things we'd really rather hide. I wonder what it would be like for you to have a place in your life where you led with this, looked at the absurdity of it, unapologetically owned it, and then put it to the side. At the very least, it might be refreshing to consider it from other angles. Also, to meet anyone who really wants to be a stand-up comic is to realize whatever your own trials are, you are far healthier than the average person who wants to be a stand-up comic. Give it a try. Okay, I think that's enough bad advice for today. And remember, I can't give you bad advice if you don't ask for it. Your question doesn't have to be profound, complex, or emotionally demanding. It can be about pretty much anything because, let's face it, I am unqualified to offer advice across a wide range of subject matter. And as we all know, sometimes the nuttiest question gets the best bad advice. You can reach me on Twitter, at QuinnCy, that's QUINNCY at twitter.com. Or you can post a question to qcbad.com. Just log into letter Q, letter C, BAD.com, and there's a question form right there. The question can be any length, but I'm finding they work better if they're shorter. Just a hint. Before I go, I'd like to thank Richard Emmett, who composed my groovy music, and Keith Greenstein, who designed my groovy logo. People have already started asking me how they can get a bad advice fork in a toaster t-shirt or coffee mug, and my answer to them is, hang in there, we are working on it. I also want to thank Phil Rohr and Prime Rib Productions for making it possible for you to hear any of this. Okay, that's enough for now. Keep those questions coming, and I'll see you all next time.